cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
All right, let's get to it and the Market Drivers Report. Let's set the Business Week agenda, folks. Lots going on. Kriti Gupta in the house, Bloomberg Markets correspondent here at Bloomberg News. Carl Riccadonna also in the house. Welcome, welcome back. Chief Industry Economist at Bloomberg Intelligence. Both in our Interactive Broker studio. Bring out some wine and we'll have a party. But
well,
I don't know.
I don't know. Should we be partying right now?
Well, Carl, I'm going to start with you because let's start there. The jobs report, I felt like really, really smart people were like, some good news, some questionable news.
Remember when 210,000 used to be a really strong jobs report?
Way back.
Yeah, way
not
back.
Not so way back.
Long, long time ago. Disappointing result today. This was way below even the most pessimistic forecast submitted to Bloomberg. So, you know, in a month when the case count was declining and we thought that folks were becoming more comfortable with returning to the labor force and taking jobs and spending and whatnot, that wasn't the case. And so what I'm concerned is this looks a lot like November of last year when we had a big disappointment on jobs. Then over the course of November, December, the case count skyrocketed.
Right.
Sounds familiar, right?
Yeah.
And then December was a real bust for payrolls. And so this creates bad optics for a Fed that's trying to accelerate the taper at the December meeting when the case count's rising, jobs are disappointing,
Tim, and equity markets are not looking too.
We do, because it's not all bad news. There was some,
right?
there were some silver linings in there.
If you call labor force participation running at the same level it did when Jimmy Carter was president, then sure, that's good news. But there's
a long road
to come back here.
Seriously?
And you're a downer based on what demographic group you fall into by age cohort. So if we look at the very young, the new entrants to the labor force, young kids coming out of college and high school and whatnot, that has basically fully rebounded. If we look at prime working age population, it's coming back, but it's still got a ways to go. And if we look at kind of a 55-plus type of crowd, well, I'll just stop there.
Are you looking at me?
No, I was going to say, and I happen to be looking at you, but I'm not tying you into the 55-plus crowd. We know we know how old you are, and it's much younger than
that.
Do
you? I don't.
But, 55-plus crowd, it's how you feel. It's how old you feel, Carol. If we look at that demographic, very, very little recovery whatsoever.
The great resignation.
And so the problem is it the resignation or is it folks still afraid to step off of the sidelines into the labor market? A big concern of the Fed is the scarring that could potentially happen to the economy. And when you look at both prime age and older workers, they're not coming back. And if we look at it slightly different way, if we go industry by industry by industry, almost every single sector is still operating below February 2020 levels. So this is not just a leisure and hospitality story. This is broad-based across the economy.
No questions there.
Hey, Kriti Gupta, come on in here. How is this manifesting in today's trade?
Yeah, well, first off, I'm just going to add one little eco thing, even though I'm not the eco person in the room here. But November is supposed to be historically a very strong month for jobs, right, Carl? And to see a miss on this particular set of months' data is extra bad in addition to the miss. Why the market's selling off, though? It might be partially because of the payrolls report, although it's worth mentioning when the headlines did drop, the initial reaction was the opposite of what you're seeing right now. You saw futures higher. You saw the stock market open, all sectors in the green, bond yields were dipping, and then you saw the sell-off as the market opened. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this is tech-driven. A lot of this is just pulling cash off the table. But remember, it is Friday. Volume is super low. This looks a lot like what we saw last Friday, where people just aren't at their desk and they're de-risking before the weekend.
Huh.
Jobs came out at 8:30. The market turned around at 9:30, right? So you can see that it wasn't really the jobs catalyst necessarily that was driving the narrative in the markets.
That's really, so are you saying COVID or what?
Well, it really made the turn when President Biden had his press conference. And he was coughing and ill, and the press didn't care about the jobs report and cared more about his health and whatnot. And I'm not saying that drove it, but, you know, there was, the timing there. So I haven't had the time to review the full press conference yet. Maybe he said some things that the markets didn't like as well.
We should know, too, that we did hear from the president's physician just
in
the last hour.
He does not have COVID.
He doesn't have the flu. Right. The physician said this is what's referred to colloquially as a frog in one's throat. He's taking over-the-counter medication.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We've been talking about it. Certainly one of our top stories on this Friday, a jobs Friday. U.S. job growth registering its smallest gain this year, while the unemployment rate fell by more than forecast to 4.2%. That feels pretty low. Offering, though, a mixed picture that may nevertheless push the Fed to quicken the wind down of pandemic stimulus. And this is what we're all trying to figure out right now. Really, what does this all mean when it comes to monetary policy in the U.S.?
It's also happening at a time when that survey didn't even cover the part of the month where we even knew what the word Omicron meant.
Exactly. And you do wonder how that might impact things, which is why the next jobs report could be even more important. All right, let's get to it, though, because someone who sees a lot in terms of what is going on in the labor force real time, especially when it comes to millennials and Gen Z individuals. Let's bring in Catherine Minshew. She's CEO, co-founder of the job placement and career platform Use. She's on the phone in New York City. Catherine, great to have you here. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
So how do you see the labor market based on what you are seeing, the type of activity and volume that's going on in your on your platform?
You know, as you mentioned, it was a mixed job reports with both the payroll increasing by a smaller percentage than forecast, but that drop in the unemployment rate to 4.2%. And I think, frankly, it's not a huge surprise, right? There are a lot of contradictory trends in the economy right now. So I think that that this was broadly as expected by at least a lot of the folks in my corner of the labor market.
That's so interesting because it wasn't expected by economists. We heard from Carl Riccadonna that the 210,000 number that we got, that headline number that we got in the change in non-farm payrolls earlier today, that was lower than even the lowest number that came from one of the analysts surveyed by Bloomberg.
That's fair. I do think it was a little bit under prediction, but I think, first of all, we did see some additional jobs added to previous tallies in September and October, which takes away a little bit of that sting. And what we are seeing is that people who entered the labor force in November, they were hired really quickly. And so I think we have certain industries and sectors where there's white-hot competition for talent. We're seeing that in technology, in warehousing, and anything related to e-commerce. And then obviously others that that are really struggling to add jobs and struggling to hire. So hospitality, travel, leisure, and even, frankly, retail, as I think a lot of shopping moves online.
Hey, Catherine, you mentioned when we just started going a lot of contradictory trends in the economy right now. What do you see as contradictory in particular?
Well, I think that we're seeing, firstly, that a lot of newer entrants into the workforce, and particularly Gen Z and millennial job seekers, they entered, in many cases, they've just come out of this really tough employment market. 2020 was a really hard time for a lot of workers of all types, frankly, to get a job, to stay employed. But at the same time, people are much more choosy right now. And so we're seeing, spikes in worker pay. We're seeing a lot of people choose to opt out of the workforce unless they find a job or an employer that meets certain criteria. So I think we're seeing, both big differences within industries and sectors of the economy, but also some very contradictory data coming out of, again, particularly the demographic that I spend most of my time with, which is Gen Z and millennial. There's a lot of indications they're looking for more than compensation, but also at the same time, salary remains important. A lot of things in the data that I think reflect the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty in the economy right now.
What were the similarities that you saw in today's jobs report that you also find in your work and on the platform, The Muse?
Yeah, well, I think the fact that the unemployment rate is so low as certainly reflected in what we see on The Muse. We have so many employers that just literally cannot fill their roles fast enough. Yeah. And it's causing major disruption to their businesses. I'm sure you're hearing about it from other guests. But some of that is because some workers are opting out. Some of that is because workers are raising their standards, like I mentioned. And so, we've also been surveying a lot of workers about what factors are they considering when they're thinking about whether to get back into the labor market, whether to change companies or change jobs. And people are flagging things like, they're looking for better perks and benefits than they had in the past. They are looking for companies that are committed to diversity, equity, and inclusion. There's a lot of burdens on employers that weren't perhaps there two years ago before the pandemic started in the same way.
Catherine, I've been doing a bunch of reporting and research on just the growth of entrepreneurship, people starting up their own business. We saw this coming out of the financial crisis. We're seeing it once again coming out of the pandemic. Women in particular are kind of, I feel like, voting very clearly by saying maybe we don't want to go to the traditional establishment, stay in corporate America. We want the flexibility. You understand that you've started your own business, right? And it's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of stress, but you do gain a lot of flexibility. What do you make of those trends and the significance that may be having on our labor environment right now?
Absolutely. I think you're spot on. And in fact, when you look at some of the biggest technology companies that have shaped our lives today, a lot of them were started back post the financial crisis between 2008 and 2010. I think Uber, Airbnb, a number of household names. And so I'm personally excited to see what next massive companies, we see started. And then you also have a lot of people that are not starting high growth Silicon Valley businesses, but are starting small businesses, are going freelance. And I think that, it is something that has become easier than it was in the past due to all of the different off-the-shelf products and services that are designed to support entrepreneurs, to support small business owners. I am not at all surprised that a lot of women looked at the way corporations responded to COVID and said, no thanks, I'm going to set my own hours. But I do think some of those workers will reenter the more traditional labor force in the next few years. But we will also see a lot of people who this was the push they needed to get into entrepreneurship. And I think that's a really great thing for the broader economy. Obviously, right. I'm clearly biased.
No, but you understand it. You get it. We've often seen, and this year alone too, we've seen a lot of female founded companies IPO. So that is something, Tim, that we've seen as well.
Hey, Catherine, as Americans have remained on the sidelines, how concerned are you and how concerned should the Federal Reserve be about scarring when it comes to this job market? The idea that people who are off the sidelines for a long period of time will have a lot of trouble returning to the job market.
Yeah, it's a really big issue. And I think it's exacerbated by the fact that the skills most in demand by many employers today are not the ones that were taught or prioritized, 10, 20 years ago. You have incredible demand in a lot of digital technologies, data-focused roles. And so I think that, as a society, as individual companies, I'm hearing retraining and reskilling be talked about more and more, because I do think that you have both just the natural scarring of people who have been out of the workforce for a while, but also the fact that some of the jargon and the skills that are most in demand change. And if you don't have programs and ways for people to get that current again, I think you have the risk that a lot of people won't be able to do it without support.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Hey, Catherine, thank you so much. Great snapshot on what's going on, certainly among the younger generation when it comes to today's labor force. That's Catherine Minshew. She's founder and chief executive officer of The Muse, joining us on the phone in New York City.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, this week, we know, right? It's been all about the latest COVID variant. At least that's been one of our really main stories. It certainly has impacted financial markets. In this week's issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, Bloomberg's Cynthia Kunz notes that whether or not it's a game changer, Omicron is COVID's future. And Tim, got to say, timely story considering what we've seen and the spread of the latest variant. I mean, we've heard from Anthony Fauci. We've heard from President Biden this week about it. We're going to hear from Dr. Anthony Fauci again a little bit later on.
Well, let's hear from Cynthia Kunz, U.S. healthcare reporter at Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from New Jersey, as well as Joel Weber, editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. He joins us on the Access line from Brooklyn. Joel, I want to toss it over to you, because if there's one theme that Carol and I have experienced when speaking with doctors and experts throughout the week about the Omicron variant, it's wait and see. We just don't know yet. The data just aren't there.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll say that that goes for our reporting as well, because all of our reporting is going to be based on this. So what we can do, though, is talk to as many people as we can in pharma and without about sort of what their approach is going to be. And that's sort of where Cynthia came in here, is like, look, we've actually seen this game before. We've had multiple variants already, and to some extent, that is really going to inform how pharma approaches it and everyone else as well. But until we know a little bit more about this thing and the data, I think everything is a little premature. But Cynthia, based on what we do know, what can we expect?
So the great news is that pharma companies can move very quickly in actually assessing whether or not the vaccines that we have taken are going to be effective against Omicron. And that's partly because of the work they can do in the lab. They can actually take a look at how the variant performs against the vaccine in the lab. And that's data we could have soon. That data is, they've said, within weeks, and they started that work right away. And the reason they were able to start that work right away is that they've done this fire drill with Beta, with the South Africa variant that was identified in South Africa prior to this one. They also did it with Delta, and they started making boosters that were targeted for those variants previously. And so those actual tailored vaccines are also partly how they know what to do in this instance. And actually, there are some overlaps between Omicron and Beta that allow Moderna, for example, are going to test their Beta-targeted vaccine as well to see if it works against this mutation of the virus. But of course, the reason everyone's saying wait weeks, if not longer, to see how this actually develops is that we've had scares before. And if you think back to Delta, I mean, Delta took over, but it didn't take over as quickly as we might be remembering it in retrospect. It actually became a variant of concern in India, and then it took over in India, and then it took over in the UK, and then it came here. So it could actually take some time. And it has to be a mutation that's strong enough to overtake Delta. And so we don't know any of that yet. So I think what a lot of people are trying to glean from a case here or a case there is very premature, because it's really a matter of seeing how it performs as a virus in a lot of people. And that's just going to take more time than I think, you know, people don't want to wait. But unfortunately, right, that's why people keep scientists keep saying you have to wait.
Well, Cynthia, I want to drill in on the idea that the large pharmaceutical companies, specifically Pfizer and Moderna, are working quickly to create vaccines or understand the effect that these are having on the vaccines that exist right now. How much of this is about the fact that these are mRNA platforms, not necessarily new technology, but new technology for vaccine delivery that we've seen play out over the last year?
Yeah, that's the really cool part about having mRNA vaccines. They're able to sort of plug in the sequence once they have it. They don't have to grow the virus, which can take weeks or months. And so in order to actually make a tailor-made vaccine, it takes much less time. Production is much faster. They have facilities now ready all over the world. So if they're going to have to switch to a new version of the vaccine, they can do it in such a wide scale and much more quickly than if it was a traditional vaccine. Like flu vaccines can take 6 to 9 months to make, from identifying what strains of the flu you're going after to actually having a vaccine to put in somebody's arm. And this is just much faster than that. Pfizer has said 100 days. It's just remarkable how fast they'll be able to do this. But of course, you know, it's a matter of not just making it, but also just knowing that you need it. And so, and also then also do, how do they, the industry, make the pivot between, say, the vaccine we have now? Does a tailor-made vaccine become a booster? Does it replace the vaccine we have now? These are big questions that need to be answered if this is deemed a necessity. So we're still really far away from that. But I think the mutation alone highlights the fact that this is going in the direction of the sort of flu vaccine model, and we probably are going to need somewhat different vaccines on a regular basis if coronavirus is going to linger like this in the population.
Cynthia, I wonder, do we finally have, has everybody finally gotten the memo that, hey, folks, this was a really bad pandemic. We're probably going to get more, and we got to start preparing for things. So even if Omicron doesn't turn out to be, and you write about this in your story, doesn't turn out to be maybe as problematic, which fingers crossed, legs crossed, everything crossed that it doesn't, you know, we are developing methodologies, approaches, tools that will help us in the future and that will be probably needed in the future.
I hope that's the case. I certainly anecdotally have heard a lot. There's a lot of demand for booster shots now, which is great because it's all we have. And boosting immunity to what's circulating in the community is still really important public health tool. But we still do have a substantial amount of vaccine hesitancy in this country. And I've heard from some experts that we really need to focus on those completely unvaccinated populations, because what we have seen from Omicron is that it can infect someone who's already had coronavirus. And we have parts of this country where vaccination rates are quite low, and Delta ripped through those populations. And those people might be more vulnerable to Omicron, if that's how this plays out, than, you know, had they gotten a vaccine. And I think there is some perception in some parts of the population that having had COVID is how you build your immunity. And unfortunately, with this virus, that just turned out to be the case. So I think there are some encouraging signs, and the booster campaign hopefully will continue to gain steam. But I think really focusing as a public health community on that deeply entrenched unvaccinated population and trying to get to more people is really going to be the answer here.
Okay, so what about the global conundrum? Because worldwide, there are fewer people who have had access to mRNA vaccines than the other technologies. There's still like just millions upon millions of people who just don't have the vaccine. As long as those people remain unvaccinated, we're going to continue to see mutations that, you know, there will be things long after Omicron, right?
And Cynthia, just quick, about 25 seconds.
Sure. I think one of the really encouraging things, though, that we don't talk enough about is that there are other vaccines coming down the pike that may not require the refrigeration of the mRNA vaccines. And that's really important to get vaccine into parts of the world that may not have the facilities to store the mRNA vaccines. So I think we do need to keep an active eye on that. I do think there is a lot more vaccine coming, and we do need to support that as a global community.
Right.
The countries that can afford to donate need to donate more. And I think that's the only way we can get finish with this.
You hear it from leaders constantly. It's a global pandemic, folks, which needs global solutions and cooperation. Cynthia Kuhn, you're amazing. U.S. healthcare reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone from New Jersey. Jill Weber, have a great weekend. Editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, on the Access Line from Brooklyn. Check out the magazine. It's all about the Bloomberg 50. That story, too, in the magazine.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Where you are listening. listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser along with Tim Stenovic in our Interactive Brokers studio, streaming on YouTube. We mentioned some of the COVID headlines earlier. We are going to be talking our David Westin with Dr. Anthony Fauci a little bit later on, so we'll get the latest on how he sees the Omicron variant. In the meantime, South Africa's daily number of confirmed COVID-19 cases almost quadrupling since Tuesday as that variant spreads across the country. And I think, Tim, I don't know if this is the latest, but this is the latest, I think, according to our measurement, at least six U.S. states have Omicron cases.
Yeah, but I think it's safe to say, given what we know about this virus, that it's likely in other states as well, Carol. Let's get into it with Dr. Ian Lustbader. He's clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone's Medical Center. He joins us on the phone from New York. Dr. Lustbader, how are you?
Hey, happy Friday, guys. Nothing to panic about. Do not overreact.
Okay.
This, please.
Please go on. Why?
So, you know, in my opinion, I think people are really overreacting to the news on Omicron. It, in my opinion, this is not going to have any material effect on the stock market, the economy, or life in the United States unless we overreact with, you know, lockdowns and travel bans and so forth, all of which really have been proven not effective. Omicron really is behaving like many viruses. Most or many respiratory viruses evolve over time to become more contagious and really less lethal, less virulent. And they adapt that way to outcompete. And it, to me, it certainly looks like Omicron is going to outcompete Delta, both in people who've either been vaccinated or have had Delta or who have had vaccines, and certainly in the unvaccinated. It's a very efficient virus. The incubation period is longer. It's about a 10-day incubation period. It's more contagious and less lethal, which is really how viruses evolve. And overall, there are many people who feel this is actually good news because it probably will end the pandemic a little bit sooner, since I think it's going to outrun any of the vaccines that we're going to be able to either develop or try to distribute to the rest of the world. That's my take on it.
Hey, listen, Dr. Lustbader, when you say it'll probably end the pandemic sooner, because what, it'll create much more of a global immunity? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think more people, this is highly contagious. I think it's, as Tim says, it's probably in many places. We have not really been testing for it. We don't, especially in the United States. You know, we do testing, COVID swabs, but that doesn't routinely distinguish between any of the variants. So for all we know, there are many places now that we're going to test for it that has it. But it doesn't really change the way you manage it. If anything, it seems like the disease is more mild. And this is really how viruses mutate. You know, they don't want to kill the host because then they die off. Now, you know, there are some, you know, potential risks, meaning obviously there are a lot of mutations, more, you know, more contagious. Could this be more like a common cold now where you get reinfection and kind of a seasonal variation and that it doesn't really go away? That is a possibility.
So how should... You're saying don't panic. You say it's likely that it could overwhelm the world. It'll spread quickly. Should we've talked to you for we've talked to you for longer than
years.
I've worked here. Okay, that's what I'll say. and I'm wondering,
as
Dr.
long
Lustbader,
as the pandemic has been around, probably even longer.
Yeah, even longer. And I'm wondering, Dr. Lustbader, if we should change our behavior in any way versus how we were behaving, let's say, 10 days ago before this entered our lexicon.
So I don't think so. You know, I think prudence is always good. We certainly know to some degree many respiratory infections are improved with masks. They're not 100%. It's certainly somewhat helpful. Don't, you know, push the envelope in very crowded, you know, areas. But I think based on the way Delta behaved and the way this is going to behave, I think everyone sooner or later is going to be coming down with Omicron. The good news is it's going to be, for most people, very mild. It's not going to be lethal. It doesn't seem to be killing more people or hospitalizing more people or raising the death rate. How that will ultimately spill out when the rest of the world begins to get it, is unclear. My sense is, like the common cold virus, the rhinoviruses, you know, mm-hmm. people get rhinoviruses and common cold viruses probably several times a year. That may be what happens with this, but it is not going to affect our life any more than getting a cold would be, and you don't go into the office if you're coughing or sneezing. You don't want to infect other people. So I don't think it should affect us in any way more than that.
Does that mean we're out of the woods of the possibility of a variant that is more virulent and also really contagious?
Well, this has over 30 mutations. And probably arose in someone who is immunocompromised, who didn't really mount a good immune response. Could theoretically another variant occur? I think it's possible. This one seems pretty efficient, spreads easily, doesn't kill the host. Most people don't know they have it. It's really almost a very mild, you know, cough or tickle in the back of your throat. It does cause some fatigue, so people after they're infected often are somewhat fatigued. So I don't think we're going to get a son of Omicron variant, but I do think this is going to spread around the world, and I think the worst thing to do would be to panic or overreact when there's really no change that we need to do in a meaningful way.
Dr. Lesbader, what changes your mind?
You know, I think if we get more data that this is again changing or killing more people or hospitalizing more people, okay, that's a problem. I think by the time we get a vaccine, and it is reasonable to develop a vaccine, that's going to be a couple of months, I think we're going to be so far behind the spread that it's not going to be meaningful. We do need to work on vaccines, both for influenza, right? We do a yearly influenza trying to catch up with the old one. There can be universal vaccines that focus not and the spike protein, which mutates all the time, we saw 30 mutations here just in the receptor binding area of the spike, but in other areas of the virus that don't mutate as much, that antibodies to that might be more effective in eliminating this on a more permanent basis. We still don't have a universal flu shot. You take one flu shot, you're good for, you know, the rest of your life. We do a yearly flu shot. We may need something like that for COVID unless we develop a more universal antibodies to a different part of it.
All right, got to run. Hey, have a good weekend. Dr. Ian Lesbader, clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone Medical Center.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's get to it with crypto content creator, crypto investor himself, Ben Armstrong. He's founder of BitBoy Crypto and the YouTube channel that goes by the same name, a self-proclaimed crypto millionaire, because you've got to show me that you are a crypto millionaire. He joins us on the phone in Atlanta. Ben, just having some fun. Good to have you here with Tim and myself. How are you?
Yeah, doing great today, despite the market drop today. But yeah, doing great. Glad to talk to you.
Well, let's talk about what, you know, you have been doing in this world that you have developed, your BitBoy Crypto YouTube channel. Tell us what it tells us more broadly about crypto investing, who's getting into it, and the interest that is out there.
Yeah, so we have the largest crypto community in all the interwebs, as we like to say. We've got almost 6 million total followers between YouTube, Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, a few other social channels. And, you know, what we see is we view ourselves as the mainstream channel. We're the bridge to get people into crypto. So a lot of times people will come to my community and come and watch our educational videos, our daily live streams, our topical videos. And they'll get real excited, and they may decide they want to delve a little deeper into maybe trading or deeper into NFTs or deeper into, you know, other spaces. And then sometimes they'll go to other channels. But most of the people that are coming into crypto today, at least with YouTube and other social medias, they're kind of using us to get there. So we're very proud of that. We've got very beginner-friendly content. And, you know, I think what we're seeing now when it comes to the people who are getting into crypto is there hasn't been a huge bump in retail interest here in the last few months. So, you know, we're continuing to see a lot of the same people in the space that have been in it for a while.
Why do you think there hasn't been a huge bump in retail interest?
Well, because when you look at the price, when you go back to September, kind of like you were talking about with Facebook a little while ago, you know, September's, you know, started off a pretty good time in October. We've really kind of evened off since then. And so a lot of people who came in early last year, they're in big profit, and they've been here for a while, and they'll continue to be in big profit. But for those people who have came in more recent times, their profit with Bitcoin is either non-existent or it's very small, depending on when they got in. So, you know, I think people aren't necessarily looking at Bitcoin as the thing to really pull people into the markets. We've seen NFTs and metaverse talk, obviously, over the last few weeks really continue to heat up. The NFT market is down a little bit, but the metaverse stuff has really been, you know, pulling some retail people in. But to the average retail investor right now, like, Bitcoin just doesn't seem like a giant opportunity.
What about other cryptocurrencies? I mean, what can you tell from what's going on in the conversations or the interest or what people are searching on and what they want to know about interest in other digital currencies?
Right. So obviously, anytime there are projects that continue to move upwards when the market is stagnant, people become interested in those. Like I mentioned, metaverse projects, Decentraland, Sandbox, those are two that people have really been looking at. But we go with just some of the more traditional projects that have been around for a while. I mean, Ethereum right now is starting to generate a lot of interest again. We're looking, you know, one chart I like to look at is the Ethereum versus Bitcoin pair. Mm. And this is the value of one Ethereum coin versus the value of one Bitcoin. And we finally have seen that break into a really large uptrend, and a lot of analysts are predicting it to go parabolic, where one Ethereum will be over 10% the value of one Bitcoin. And we're at a place right now where the Ethereum market dominance is rising and the Bitcoin market dominance is falling. You know, it's kind of a recipe where we could, in the next few months, see Ethereum at least temporarily pass Bitcoin. And I think that's something that's super exciting to people. Of course, I'm talking about the market cap.
Yeah, not the price.
Price.
The prices, they're quite different right now. But speaking of price, Bitcoin price right now, Ben, is really cratering today. It's down more than 6.5% at $53,000. What do you make of the volatility that we've seen and how it could potentially scare away people who haven't yet invested?
Yeah, so the volatility is something very terrifying to people. And that's why I've really been talking a lot at different speaking engagements that I've had and talking with different people that, you know, there are people that are going to be risk adverse. They're going to be scared away from Bitcoin because of volatility. You can't really talk someone in to being, you know, risky. So those people that are risk adverse, they're going to look at the volatility of Bitcoin and they're going to be scared, and they're not going to come into this market for a long time until it stabilizes maybe 15 years from now. So the people that are in crypto today and have reaped all the benefits, they've got a little bit of that risk factor, a little bit of that risk gene in them. So you're never going to talk somebody into being risky, in my opinion. You know, especially investors or savvy investors, they've already got a plan. They're going to stick with what works. That's why the newer generation is coming into crypto a little more, because, you know, when you're younger, you're a little riskier than, you know, as you get a little bit older. So that's one thing we're seeing. But what's really interesting to me about the Bitcoin price that we've been noticing over the last, you know, week or so, is that it really has been following the stock market a pretty good bit. And so today we get the jobs report. Bitcoin had actually recovered overnight and was going back up. I think it was above $58,000 or very close. And then the job report came out and Bitcoin shot back down because the traditional markets also felt the impact from that jobs report. So I think that that's something we could continue to see for a little bit. But ultimately, I do believe that December will be a big month for Bitcoin in spite of this, drop that we've had today.
Okay, we'll talk about that a little more in just a second. But is a drop like today's where we see Bitcoin at around 53,200, is that an entry point for you? Is that a buying opportunity?
Well, the $53,000 level has been extremely strong, and it has bounced off of that several times. Right now, it is hovering right at that number almost exactly. But I do think it is a pretty good price point to get in at. We've seen the $52,000 to $54,000 range be very, very strong for Bitcoin. And I don't think there's, especially with the options the futures expiring this morning. You know, I think that's, you know, on Deribit, which is the world's biggest, you know, Bitcoin futures and Ethereum futures exchange, I think that frees up a little bit for us to possibly get some upward movement over the weekend. I definitely think it is, it's possible. So, yeah, it's definitely interesting times for Bitcoin, but $53,000, you know, used to be a good price point.
Well, it's interesting too, and I was just looking. Bitcoin's off about 21% from its November 9th high. Ethereum off about 13% from that moment as well. S&P hit a high back on November 18th, and it's only down a few percentage points, I think, from that. Forgive me, I was just looking, and down about 4%. So we definitely have seen the cryptocurrency world take it more on a chin. Who should be investing in cryptocurrencies, in your view?
Yeah, so here at BitBoy Crypto, our mission is to empower people to find financial freedom through crypto assets. So if you're someone who is looking to change your life financially, crypto has shown over and over and over again that over the long term, not over 1 month, not over 2 months, you can find financial freedom through crypto assets. So if you're someone who's already found financial freedom, you know, if you're Jeff Bezos and you made all your money the old way, then why would you switch? Why would you come over? But if you're someone that is looking to change your investment strategy, looking to change your life, looking to get out of that 9-to-5 rat race, crypto offers that. The numbers on it are very clear. While we get caught up in the short-term moves of these assets, over the long term, they've continued to crush it, continue to set new all-time highs. Almost every project, you know, in the top 100 has set new all-time highs or is very close to new all-time highs this year. So because of that, you know, there are a lot of statistics that point to if you stay in crypto for 4 years or more, you will make money in this space. You will do very well. I always say, you know, it's very easy to make money in crypto. It's very hard to make money in crypto day to day.
I'm just going to say, Ben, there's some regulators who might say differently and that you've got to understand, too, that there's a lot of risk and not all cryptocurrencies are the same. Ben, come back. We would love to continue in the future. Ben Armstrong, founder of BitBoy Crypto, joining us on the phone in Atlanta.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.